We talked about wildfire smoke already in this hour. It's only natural we talk about the fires, too, and some of the extreme behavior the fires have exhibited in what is still a relatively young fire season, if you can believe that. An example, the fire NATO so many people described 2 weeks ago when the Carr fire literally roared into Redding. Scientists have confirmed that finding with evidence on the ground and measurements in the air of extremely high tornado force winds as the fire front burned into the city. We have two guests to help us understand fire conditions now and in the past. Daniel Swain is at the Center for Climate Science at UCLA. If the name sounds familiar, he joined us a few months ago to talk about the chance for precipitation whiplash in California as the planet changes. Daniel Swain, thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me back on the program.
Good to have you. Ryan Sandler joins us as well. We were just talking about the National Weather Service office in Medford in the previous segment about wildfire smoke. He is the warning coordination meteorologist at the NWS office there. Ryan, good to have you back on the program.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
So just for either of you right off the bat, Ryan, were you surprised to find the amount of fire activity so far this year and when in the year it is taking place?
Well, normally we would be very surprised, but we always key in on lightning, and we knew how dry things were leading into our lightning outbreak in mid-July. And once we had over 3,000 lightning strikes in the region, we knew we were in for big trouble.
Yeah, there were a bunch, and that was the July 15th lightning storm was the one that did. How many did you say?
If you just look at Siskiyou and Modoc County in California and most of southern Oregon, we had over about 2,250 lightning strikes, and those are ground strikes. So there are even more strikes within the cloud to air, but that's just the ones that matter to us, the ones on the ground.
Yeah, I do notice that the lightning strikes don't seem to be distributed evenly, and there are times when I look at your forecast and forecast discussions coming out of the National Weather Service office in Medford and notice that, for example, the Yreka area will have an evening where there's a bunch of lightning that strikes there, but nowhere else it seems like in the area. What are some of the dynamics going on there, Ryan?
We have some lightning hotspots in our region, and between the Scott and Shasta Valley and those mountains, we usually see development, the Trinity Alps in that region, and then those storms move into the Shasta Valley very frequently. We also see, strangely enough, a hotspot around Chemult and Lapine. In that area, there's more lightning strikes, and Crater Lake as well.
Okay, so just a couple of places where there's some high terrain, it seems like, that direct the air a certain way?
Yeah, the high terrain pretty much always directs it around here. It's unusual when it doesn't because it's always forcing the air up and producing clouds when we have enough moisture. Usually we don't have that moisture available, but we certainly did on July 15th.
And so, Daniel Swain, let me come to you and come back to the original question I had for Ryan, which is whether you're surprised to find the amount of fire activity so far this year.
Well, as we mentioned, the conditions have been so dry, not just in southern Oregon, but also really throughout California and actually across the broader Southwest this year and in recent years, that as large as the numbers are in terms of number of fires and acreage burned at this relatively still early juncture in the fire season, I can't say that folks are surprised, because we knew the risk was there. Given ignitions, we knew that these fires were going to spread quickly and behave extremely and get quite big. Interestingly, in California this year, we've had a very different kind of trigger for these fires. We've actually had a pretty light summer lightning season so far. There have been very few lightning-caused fires because it just hasn't been a whole lot of lightning south of the absolute northernmost part of the state, so really essentially from that region around Yreka northward. South of that line, we haven't seen too many naturally ignited lightning fires, but what we have seen are a bunch of human-caused fires, mostly accidentally caused, but still human-caused fires really throughout the state, all the way from the Carr fire near Redding down all the way to the fires you've seen burning in far southern California. But what the commonality is here, regardless of what actually causes a spark that starts the fire, the problem is that the backrock conditions have just been so dry and so warm as well this summer. This past July was now officially the warmest July on record in the state of California, and in fact, I believe, the single warmest month in California history. that we've seen these antecedent dry conditions and this extremely dry vegetation that was followed by this month, this past 30-day period, that was exceptionally hot in most places. And that's really driving a large part of the risk that we've been seeing.
Ryan Sandley, you have some similar figures, I think, for the Medford National Weather Service office, don't you, about the how hot July was?
Oh, yeah. It wasn't the warmest, but it was right up in the top five in 108 years. And before the lightning outbreak, we had 3 days that were over 100 degrees here in the Rogue Valley. And following the lightning, we had 2 days over 100 degrees. So it was extremely dry both before and after the lightning strikes, which is the worst-case scenario. And then we got some windy conditions as well that just made it that much worse. But, yeah, it's been a very dry year. Much of Oregon and even parts of California are in moderate to severe drought. So, and I think the fire agencies realized how bad it was. They keep track of what's called energy release component, how dry the dead and live fuels are. And they were near records right before we had our lightning outbreak in mid-July.
You know, I guess what happened was I got lulled into complacency myself, or I'm an optimist or some combination thereof, because I remember thinking after the 4th of July, it didn't crack, I think, 95 degrees in Medford, that hey, you know, between this and the fact that we had some rain all into June, things might be okay this summer. Well, count me as among the very wrong. We did get rain fairly far into the spring, Ryan. Why then did it end up the way it did?
The temperatures were so warm. May was one of the warmest on record, and May was pretty dry. We did get, you're right, April was close to normal, but we really dried out and warmed up in May, and I think that's what set the stage for what happened. It turned out that our snowpack melted about 3 weeks early, and that was mostly a result of May.
All right. So what we're talking about the general weather conditions that have led to this season's wildfires. I want to get into some specifics about wildfire conditions themselves. Ryan Sandler is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Medford. He's the warning coordination meteorologist. Daniel Swain is with the Center for Climate Science at UCLA. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Lots of questions you may have about atmospheric conditions for fires and what happens within them. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Daniel Swain, it seems like you're pretty knowledgeable about just about anything that goes on with fires and the lands that can burn in California. Have you had a chance to look at some of the data coming out of the Fire NATO, as people have called it, from the Carr Fire?
Yeah, I've actually been following that event fairly closely, partly out of personal fascination and horror, but also because it is sort of an interesting meteorological sort of development. It's quite distinct, really, from anything that we've seen in California on previous fires. It's not the first fire vortex, of course. Those are not actually all that uncommon. They do tend to occur on large, intensely burning wildfires, really the world over. But this one in particular was extraordinary for a few specific reasons, the first of which is just simply how strong it ended up becoming. The National Weather Service in Sacramento, which is the office that covers the northern end of the Sacramento Valley, essentially has estimated that this event was similar in strength to an EF3 tornado. And that's a 3 on a scale of 5. So that suggests winds of around 140 or 150 miles an hour moving in a localized cyclonic sense. That's very, very strong wind for an event like this, and it would actually make it among the strongest tornado-like events really anywhere along the U.S. West Coast, actually, and it was generated by a wildfire. So that in itself is pretty extraordinary. And the really interesting part of this is that these were very localized winds. This was not a fire being driven by the kind of relentless offshore winds like we saw in last year's fires in California, the Santa Rosa tragedy or the Thomas Fire in Southern California, which were driven by these large-scale Santa Ana or Diablo warm and dry winds from land to sea. Instead, in this case, what we had was a fire that was mostly being driven by the extreme heat and vegetation dryness in the region and the local topography that managed to generate its own weather. Essentially, it generated its own small-scale weather system directly over the city of Redding and created this fire-induced thunderstorm cloud, which produced a large tornado-like vortex. And people, meteorologists and fire scientists, have been studying this event with keen interest because, as far as they can tell, this is one of the best documented and strongest fire vortices on record, really anywhere.
So, Ryan Sandler, back us up a couple steps, because we do often talk about the red flag warnings and the fact that those do involve high winds, high heat, low humidity. But this was not a red flag kind of day, I think, is what I'm hearing Daniel say, that yes, it was hot as all blazes, 113, but not really windy?
As I recall that day, there was... It was probably a little windier than typical, but especially in the afternoon, you're going to get some gustiness. And when it's really dry and you get a fire going, it doesn't take that much wind to really spread the fire. I mean, gusts to 20 miles an hour, which aren't uncommon, will spread a fire like that quickly. Remember, the fuels are just, they're tinder dry and they're ready to go. So it doesn't take, you don't need gusts to 40 miles an hour. And like Daniel mentioned, the fire itself creates wind. And so you have extra wind on top of the regular wind.
Is that just the force of combustion? That's what's making that wind?
Yeah, the heat, the temperature differences will help create that. And yeah, we often see that right around big fires, there's a more wind.
Is this like convection at a higher speed then, where the air is rising because it's just that hot?
Exactly. It's strong, very intense convection that's doing that.
So I mean, we have the general knowledge of fire whirls. Tell us what those are, Ryan, and how different this idea of a fire tornado is from that.
Well, I'm sorry, Daniel, you want to go?
That was for Ryan.
Oh, sure.
Okay, go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, so I think, you know, as we just heard, the large fires, whether they're wildfires or really any kind of fire, generate a lot of heat near the surface of the earth. And as that hot air starts to rise, it can induce its own wind currents. So in a fire like this, this particular fire was on the west side of the city of Reading, you had rapidly rising air in this column above the fire because it was so hot and buoyant. And air essentially began to rush in from all directions to fill the void. So that's how you get those normal fire-induced convective winds. But what happened in this case is that the atmosphere was in a state where it was a little bit unstable, so similar to a condition where you might, under other circumstances, see cumulus clouds or maybe even a thunderstorm. Once that air started to rise, it continued to rise, sort of in a self-sustaining way. And in this case, it reached almost 40,000 feet in height. So this smoke plume, this pyrocumulonimbus cloud right on top of the fire, was, if it were daylight when this were occurring, it would have essentially looked like a thunderstorm cloud. And what we saw actually on radar imagery and when the folks are looking at the data after the fact is that this essentially was a cloud similar to the kind we would see that would produce a more traditional tornado. The entire cloud, for example, was rotating up even tens of thousands of feet up in the air. And so the difference between a more traditional fire whirl, which you see these small spin-ups that occur sort of on the fire front on your typical wildfire, they're usually maybe 50 to a couple hundred feet tall, may last anywhere from a few seconds to a minute or two. But this rotating column was several tens of thousands of feet deep, and the vortex, the feature in question, lasted over an hour. Speed in these might more typically be in the 40 or 50 mile an hour range, but in this case were essentially three times that, almost 150 miles an hour. And so this really was in a class of its own. The fire whirls themselves, of course, are quite common on wildfires, but something of this magnitude, as far as I know, had not previously been documented in California or even actually in the United States.
I want to go back and underline some of those numbers. You're saying a normal fire whirl is maybe 50 to a couple of hundred feet tall. This was tens of thousands of feet tall and lasted for an hour.
Yeah, and I should clarify that the tens of thousands of feet part, the quote-unquote fire tornado itself wasn't that tall, but the whole rotating cloud that was attached to it was. So it was part of this broader cloud system that was much on a much larger scale than would typically be the case.
So I want to remind our audience who we're talking to here. We're talking to Daniel Swain, who's with the Center for Climate Science, the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. We talked to him a few months ago about precipitation whiplash. So he's been studying the long-term effects of climate change. Ryan Sandler deals with it on a daily basis, where he's the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service office in Medford. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Questions about fire behavior, about the conditions that lead to extreme fire behavior, just fires plain. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Ryan, I mean, for the guys who deal with things meteorologically on a daily basis, I read the forecast discussions fairly regularly and see things like, well, our guidance would suggest that we'll hit 103 in Medford today, but with the smoke, it could be 5 degrees less. I mean, are you dealing with combinations of conditions that you never used to see before?
Yeah, it makes forecasting more challenging. The smoke scatters some of the sunlight and absorbs some, and so it doesn't reach, the sunlight doesn't reach the ground as strong. And you can feel it. If you're outside in the middle of the day, it does not feel as hot. The smoke is miserable, but it knocks the temperature down 5-7 degrees depending on how thick the smoke is. And the computer models were thinking yesterday would be about 105, 106, and it turned out 98 in Medford because they are not aware that there's so much smoke in the air. And it also keeps the nighttime temperatures up too. So we've seen a lot of lows in the 60s, which is warm for around here.
And then the smoke can work back on the fires too, can't it, Ryan? So they can keep the fires capped in a sense. There's not as much activity around them because the smoke on top of them.
Yep, that's exactly true. Sometimes from the fire, its own fire, and sometimes from fires nearby that bring smoke in. But it does help. It hurts them when they're trying to work with airplanes and the visibility's poor. They can't fly in it. But it does keep the fire conditions put down somewhat.
And so, Daniel Swain, as you look at some of the data coming out of this season's fires, I mean, do you begin to adjust predictions on what fires can do in future years if the sets of conditions that we're dealing with here continue and or get added to?
Yeah, I mean, we wrote a perspective piece yesterday, actually, in The Guardian, and with a couple of fire scientists, essentially pointing out the fact that the fires we've been seeing in recent years in California are behaving very differently from the ones that firefighters were used to dealing with throughout much of the 20th century, in the sense that they're not necessarily more numerous. In fact, arguably, there may even be fewer fire starts in California than there were decades ago. That's partly a success of fire prevention programs. The problem is that the fires that are getting started are burning much hotter, much more intensely, and becoming much larger. And so, in other words, they're both more dangerous to fight on the firefighter side, and they're more dangerous if you happen to live in a wildfire risk zone, because it means that they're more likely to actually burn structures, and they're more likely to threaten people's lives, which unfortunately we've seen that they really do in some of these cases in the last couple of years in California. And there's sort of a confluence of factors that are causing this trend towards more intense and larger fires, both in California and elsewhere. You know, there's this background situation where we, for much of the 20th century, suppressed to a very high degree fire activity artificially, which led to a deficit of natural fire and an accumulation of forest fire fuel in the forest because we weren't having those natural low-intensity fires. It's also the case that people have moved into high-risk zones at a much higher rate than they used to, so we have more people living in harm's way. But on top of that, we have this overriding factor of climate change, the fact that the climate is now much warmer than it once was, and that is acting to amplify the dryness of vegetation and making those first two problems, which are those human factors, just that much worse. And unfortunately, all three of those factors are acting in the same direction, in the sense that they're all increasing the risk.
Let's take a call here from John in Veneta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Daniel Swain and Ryan Sandler. John, you're up.
I was just going to go over something real quick. I'm an old hell attacker, and our FCO used to have us watch the Dresden firestorm that the English and Americans video or filmed back then every spring. And on my old home district, which was rigged in the Cascades, we were doing a broadcast burn in virgin timber, and it was a virgin timber logging, and it was the steepest drainage in the unit, I mean the district. And that twister was about the same height as the firs around there, which were 250 to 300 feet.
Wow.
And it was so loud, it sounded like a Saturn rocket. If I, in my imagination, I never heard a Saturn rocket. But you had to yell at a couple hundred, 150, 200 yards, you had to yell at your buddy to get any kind of communication done. It was absolutely the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life.
All right, so a lot of air moving there. Ryan Sandler, we've already established that. So that explains some of the roaring sound that people hear with tornadoes, the freight train sound, isn't it? Ryan, are you there?
Yes. Yeah, I'm sorry, what was the question?
It wasn't so much a question, it's just a statement. I mean, it's really just a freight train sound. I mean, it's the rushing of the air, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it is. And the air accelerates, and I've never witnessed anything like that, but yeah, a lot of people have, and it's always the same kind of loud sound.
Ryan, just a couple of seconds left here. We've generally avoided more lightning west of the Cascades, it seems, since the initial storm of July 15th. Is that luck going to run out at some point, or might we see a clearing trend, or what do you see down the road?
Well, the foreseeable future, the good news is it looks like we don't see lightning, any widespread lightning. The bad news is it looks like it's going to warm up after it cools down a little bit this weekend. So and the rest of the month looks warmer than normal and very dry. So that's not good news. But we don't see any lightning coming up.
We'll take what little good news we can get from the weather right now. So obviously an extreme fire season with lots of smoke. I want to thank Ryan Sandler, Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service, and Daniel Swain from the Center for Climate Science in UCLA. Good discussion. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.